Hi, my name is Patrick Cohen, and I'm a graduate student intern with the COVID-19 Archive at ASU. The date is March 14th, 2021, and the time is 1:34 p.m. I'm speaking with my mom, Brenda Cohen. I want to ask you a question about your pandemic experience, but before I do, I would like to ask you for your consent to record this response for the COVID-19 Archive. The COVID-19 Archive is a digital archive at ASU that is collecting pandemic experiences. Do I have your consent to record your response and add it to the archive with your name?
Yes.
So first, I just want to ask you some background questions. So number one, how are you doing today?
Doing very well, thank you.
And do you have any family?
Yes.
Okay, and can you tell me about them?
Well, I come from a large family, and I'm married, and I have a son, you, Patrick, one, and I have three brothers, three sisters, and my mom is still alive.
Right. How old are you?
Today I am.
Yeah, today's your birthday. Sorry.
Today's my birthday, yeah. And I am 57 years old.
Well, happy birthday first.
Thank you.
What's your birthday?
March 14th, 1964.
Oh, okay. And what do you do for a living?
I'm a certified crime and intelligence analyst with the Calgary Police Service, and my current position is a supervisor in the real-time operations center. I supervise information coordinators who work in a 24/7 work environment. And I have 16 permanent information coordinators that I supervise who work on four separate teams, as I said, in a 24/7 work environment. Plus I supervise one analytical technician and three crime intelligence analysts that work in the major, one works in major events and emergency management, and the other two work in our traffic safety unit.
Mm. I think I understand that. It's just, can you describe what the job is in particular? Like, can you, I guess, not dumb it down, but.
So the, at the Calgary Police Service, we have a quadrant or a group of civilian employees who are trained to work with investigators and frontline officers and our incident commanders to analyze data, to analyze information, and to analyze intelligence. And we put all of that information together in different forms of products that help police officers make decisions. So in the real-time operations center, we have a duty inspector who oversees all of the calls for service that occur in the city of Calgary, calls for service for police, for law enforcement. And that duty inspector has the ultimate say over a lot of the calls that occur. Normally, most calls are handled at the officer in the patrol unit level. But we oversee those calls that escalate or become what we call isolated events or exigent events where that ultimately would result in the duty inspector making the ultimate decision to shoot to kill. And that is the responsibility of the duty inspector if that incident ever occurs. A lot of the elevated incidents that we become what we call extracted are extortion type calls, kidnapping, violent offenses with guns, firearms, crimes against people that happen in real time. Anything else that happens, like a homicide or whatever, then the homicide unit is engaged. They come out and they take over the investigation, and then we go on with our regular activities of continuing to monitor the calls for service. So I supervise those information coordinators who are continually monitoring the calls. They have access to over 30 databases to obtain information that help the command staff make, as I said before, informed decisions. So that could be, you know, vital statistics, Equifax, financial backgrounds, mental health information that is normally private, we have access to, and it helps us to determine information on a given individual or crime group as best as we can the information that is available to us. Does that make sense? It's kind of, I'm sworn to an oath. I can't speak about investigations specifically, but it is information that normally is not open to the public, and the media releases, they only get a section of the information that we can release to them, because an ongoing investigation is private until that investigation is closed, and then it's subject to disclosure, which then becomes public information.
Okay. And how long have you been working here?
I've worked for the Calgary Police Service since 1996. I started out as a research assistant, then I went into the crime prevention unit, then I went out into the districts as a crime analyst, and I was a district crime analyst in three separate districts, and then moved to the Real-Time Operations Center in December of 2010, and moved into a supervisory position in 2015.
All right. And can you tell me what attracted you to this job?
It wasn't a job that I pursued. I got a job as a research assistant. I also got offered a job with Canada Border Services at land crossing. And because I was newly married and wanted to start a family, I didn't want to work and have to commute from a land crossing. So I took the job at the police service as a research assistant. And then from there, I basically pursued the career in crime analysis, not really knowing what it was. So I kind of lucked into it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a hard position to get into now. It's very sought after. So I'm pretty fortunate that happened to me.
Mm-hmm.
And then I took it upon myself to do my master's. I was in a master's program, and so I did another master's program while I was employed. Plus, I also pursued being certified. There's only about five of us in the police department at Calgary Police that are certified crime analysts.
Mm. And how do you become certified? Like, is there a certain prerequisite, like a class, or?
There are specific classes that you have to take, and you have to work in the area for a certain amount of time. Plus, you have to continue your education while you're pursuing the certification, and you have to write an exam.
Okay. Do you enjoy your job particularly, or not so much, or?
My background and my heart lies in crime analysis, and I don't do a lot of that. I get an opportunity to mentor and facilitate and to teach the people that I supervise, which I love to do. But I ultimately love focusing on a specific investigation and working with investigators on a particular crime or crime series. So I miss it. Mm-hmm. I miss that. And I miss working out in the district. That was fun. You built up different teams. Where I'm working right now, we have four different teams. And we go through working in a police environment. You build up friendships, and you work on relationship building and, you know, things like that, team building. But the relationships that you build with police officers is temporary, because they're constantly being moved and they go for promotion. So you retain that friendship always, but the working relationship is always changing.
Mm-hmm.
So you never kind of work with any one particular person for any great length of time, except if they're civilian. And I'm fortunate with the civilian members that I work with. They are fantastic group of individuals.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So now we're going to move on to the background to the pandemic, if that's okay. This might be a little bit of a jump from talking about your job to COVID, but it'll work out. Sorry. So number one, do you remember where you were when you first heard about COVID-19, and what did you think about it?
Yeah, I was on vacation with your dad in the United States, and we were coming home. And our flight got delayed, and we were stuck in an airport for 4 hours, and then we were on an airplane, and the airplane had a mechanical problem, and so we were stuck on a plane with about 100 people for almost an hour, and then we had to get off and wait for another 4 hours, and then we got back on the plane. And so I flew into Great Falls, Montana, and it was late at night. and your dad and I were just going to drive home. And I said, no, let's just stay overnight. And then, because I didn't have to be at work until the day after. So I went back to work, and it was, I think it was Thursday. And I had explained, it was March 13th, and I had explained that that I had been on a flight with a group of people. And I thought, I probably should isolate at home. And my immediate supervisor said, yes, isolate at home. But then the very next day I got phoned by the health nurse, and she said, no, come to work. And so I've been at work ever since. We had the opportunity to telework. I teleworked for a short amount of time, but because my work environment works 24/7 and the majority of my employees were working, they did not telework. They don't have the ability to telework. They're not considered an essential service, but they can't do their job from home because of the databases and the connections. Mm-hmm. So I just felt that I needed to be in the office with them as opposed to teleworking. And the other analysts and analytical technicians that I worked with, they did telework. Mm. So did I answer your question?
Yeah, no.
I heard about it and it didn't really impact me. I felt that the majority of the civilian analysts and were working and are continually teleworking. But I've been in the office ever since, and it's only impacted me by, I had, when I came back to work, I had three or four employees that were on holidays as well, and they all had to isolate for 2 weeks prior to them coming back to work. So it impacted me in terms of scheduling and finding coverage for my the people that I supervise. So, and then through work, and because I supervise the major events and management, they activated an incident management team for COVID because we were anticipating police officers coming down with COVID and that we would be in a risk situation in trying to have enough police personnel to take calls for service and to work on the street. But that never really transpired. So the first couple of months of COVID, so from March through to May and June, there was a lot of anticipation about how it was going to impact Calgary Police Service, but it never really transpired. We, right away, we had the officers wear their PPE, which is their protective police equipment, and we updated the standard operating procedures and the policies, and that they weren't allowed to go to calls without wearing their PPE, and I think that has what saved them, a lot of them, from not coming down with COVID. Of the COVID cases that our police officers have tested positive, majority of them have been through their personal interactions and not while at work, which is very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So really, you answered a lot of my questions there.
Sorry.
No, don't apologize for that, please. No. So you were saying your first interaction with COVID was essentially you, how did you feel about that? Sorry, just how did you feel about the onset of the pandemic in the first place, your feelings about it?
I think because so many people had questions, and we, from the news reports and all that, we were seeing how it had impacted a lot of the countries on the Pacific Rim, China, and it was interesting to watch some videos. I remember I watched one on how China was dealing with it and how they were at that particular time enforcing a very rigid tracing program where you couldn't leave without the government knowing exactly where you were, what you were doing. And I think that in turn was very interesting and probably spoke to the success of them dealing with the COVID pandemic in that particular country and knowing full well that that would never be allowed to occur here because governing and we just wouldn't be able to enforce those types of rigid requirements. So it was interesting to see how my country was going to enforce the lockdowns. It was interesting going to work, and I saw it in the morning, traffic was decreased. It was, sometimes it just seemed like our calls for service went down, and they have retained, they've been static. They've never increased. So because I look at calls for service overnight in a 24-hour period, and they're consistently decreased when we compare it to the previous year. So in that sense, you know, we were anticipating COVID calls going out. We were tracking them from a law enforcement perspective, but it really never transpired to the extreme that I think everybody thought it was. So for me, there was a lot of fear mongering, which was essentially we just weren't being educated or informed, I think.
And who was doing that fear mongering? The news or?
I think just in general, just communication, right? You know, how people communicate in social media and whatnot, Twitter and Instagram. And then of course the media is, I've never been a person who follows the media or believes in the media. I've always, media, you have to read between the lines, and I don't like someone else telling me what is news when in fact it's not news. Mm-hmm. I'm very kind of jaded that way, just because of my background and knowing that the news really, they don't really often know the full story or the truth of a story. So
okay. So how did COVID affect the layout of your workspace? Like you said, there's PPE, but you still in the work, and there's also this thing called telework.
Right.
Can you describe a little bit more on that?
Yeah, so telework is for those employees who could continue to do their work but do it from home in a safe environment. Because from what I could tell, the risk was more in, we didn't want to impact our medical facilities, right? So you reduce the risk of having COVID by confining yourself into an area where, you know, you wouldn't be putting yourself in a situation where you might contract the virus. So the work environments were looked at. Well, how many people can, you know, we shut down their district offices. The crime analysts, a lot of the crime analysts started working from home. They had CPS issued laptops where they had their whole desktop was there. And as I said, my crime analysts were able to work from home successfully and be able to do their job. The only thing that was missing was personal interaction. But we got through that with the online Microsoft Teams meetings and meeting online. And we stopped having meetings in a room and had them online instead. And actually, there's a lot of positives that came of it, because the meetings, to me, in my mind's eye, were right to the point. Teleworking has been productive in the sense that you don't have people coming into your office and interrupting you or, you know, having that coffee chat and all that. And you can work and then take a break and go and do something else. And then come back, ensuring that, you know, you're putting in your 10 hours, but your 10 hours aren't from, like, say 7:30 to 5:30 or whatever with an hour's lunch. You're working, you know, 4 hours and then maybe 6 hours later in the evening or whatever. But as long as you're putting in your 10 hours, there's a lot more flexibility and agility. And I think people were a lot more productive, with teleworking. In my office is removed from the Teams. They're out on the floor, what we call the floor. So they're a good 15 feet away from me. If they need to come to see me, they can come in my office wearing a mask. Or if I get out of my desk and I go to walk out onto the floor, I wear a mask. If I go out in the rest of the building, I wear a mask too. And then also my work area, the real-time operations center, is in lockdown. So we lock the doors. So if anybody needs to come in to get a warrant signed or whatever, they phone first and we let them in, and they're wearing a mask and they swear to their search warrant. We give them what is called an ITO, just a number, and then they can go and execute their warrant. But it has to be seen by the duty inspector and signed off by the duty inspector. So we're in what I would say would be a secure work environment.
Okay. So, just to confirm, like, 'cause I feel like I I'm a little confused. So it was like this before the pandemic too, as well.
Before the pandemic, our doors were open. Anybody could come in to our work environment. Now that the doors are closed, they can't. So we've reduced the exposure of our personnel to people just coming in.
Okay. Thank you. I was just confused there. That's my fault.
Nope.
So I have two questions. The first one is, do you prefer working from home? Well, you said that there's some strengths to that with the space and the time.
Mm-hmm.
Or do you prefer working in the office? If you had a choice, like, which one would you choose?
It's 50-50. It really is. I found working at home, I think I was, I could do it. I just felt so isolated from my work environment. And because of, especially, I have my door open, I can hear what's going on. So I know that I'm not there 24/7. I'm there during the day, and I'm there to support my information coordinators. But they don't particularly need me. I'm not a micromanager. I don't, you know, look over their shoulders. I read their notes. I try to help them when I can, but they can do their work without me. They come to me if they need assistance or if they need direction on something that they're not quite sure of, but I'm not there breathing on their necks and telling them what to do. But I like being there to help them and support them, because oftentimes they're dealing with events that are not very pleasant.
Mm-hmm.
And on New Year's Day, it was New Year's Eve at 10:30 at night, I got a phone call, and one of our officers was killed in the line of duty. And one of my information coordinators was the last one to speak with that officer on the phone. And so you're dealing with that. You're trying to find another team who can come in and cover for them, and at the same time you're worried about that those team members and how well they're doing. They had a debrief, and but she was the one information coordinator, had to be off work for almost 2 months, and we made sure that she had counseling. And but it took her time, and they deal with those types of situations, and that's what I'm there for, is to support them and to make sure that they're taken care of. In my line of work with the civilians, same as police officers, they might not be involved directly in a situation, but it does impact them, and they do suffer to some extent some post-traumatic stress disorder, so we have to be cognizant of that, and we never know how it's going to impact them, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you're there as a support system, and on that particular evening, New Year's Eve, I was on the phone from, I think, 10:30 till 2 o'clock in the morning, because we also activated our tactical operations center, which required me to call out an analyst and another, just making sure that there were people there to do the job, to assist, and making sure that that call, because it was an isolated event, we had to put other people onto that call to ensure that it was handled properly and investigated. And then it then fell over into Alberta ACERT, what we call ACERT, which is Alberta Services and Investigative Services Team, and they're provincial-based investigators who are who come in and investigate a situation that is separate from Calgary Police Service, because we don't want to come across that we're involved or biased, right, or mm-hmm. impact that investigation. We want it to be investigated by another. I'm not speaking very well because when I. Sorry,
okay.
I have to apologize because my mind's kind of all over the place. But we want another, what they call another impartial law enforcement agency to investigate that situation.
Okay.
Does that sound right?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay.
Perfect. This is another thing we were talking about earlier. You brought up the fact that officers would come in wearing their masks. But I remember sometimes you'd tell me they came in, they were wearing masks. Did this happen a lot, or is this just a one-time thing?
Oh, in our office, officers that are coming in, from the front line, if they come into our building, my building is separate from the headquarters. It's in the same area, but it's a, what we call our covert building, because it's where we have all of our covert surveillance investigators and specialized investigations and whatnot. And so the whole building is kind of a very secure building. So if there people are in there, it's usually people that are, if they come in to have a search warrant, they've been working in the in that office and they normally wear their masks. But sometimes if they're not wearing a mask, they're probably low for exposure risk and all that, because they've been working in the same office for quite a length of time. So really they're not that much of a risk. But there again, you don't know what they did in their personal time, right? Mm-hmm. And I think for us, the biggest fear has always been those people who are asymptomatic, because that seems to be where a lot of people contract or test positive, is because of that. But a lot of people just forget that they have their mask there, but they just come in and it's really quick and then they leave, right? Mm-hmm. So for my employees, if they're sitting at their desk for 12 hours, I don't expect them to wear their mask for 12 hours. But as soon as they get up from their desk, they're supposed to put their mask on. Mm-hmm. And they, for the most part, do. They're pretty good that way.
Okay. When there aren't masks, though, when that does happen, I remember earlier you telling me that there was some anxiety with who you supervised and they were worried every now and then. Was this?
Yeah. But it's just education, right? And it's just being mindful of that and then reminding people that, you know, you need to be wearing your mask if you're going to be around these people, because they work 24/7. They don't need to wear a mask when they're in their work environment, but that if you come into their work environment, be respectful and wear your mask, because it does cause worry and anxiety to some extent.
Okay, thank you. And next we're going to go on to the events of this summer, which were the massive protests and the ongoing protests, which have been happening throughout province recently. So this summer, there were numerous protests against police brutality and systemic racism directed towards the Calgary Police Department. Can you tell me what the atmosphere was like in your workplace when this was occurring?
In my workplace, my actual workplace in the real-time operations center, I mean, we have the news up continually. We have 6 massive screens that go across, and we have what we call our Hawks Downlink, which is camera that is attached to our Hawks, so we can watch events occurring in real time from the air. We have our corporate security camera, so we see we can view a huge amount of cameras that are in and around the city, so when we have the media on, we're listening to what people are saying. We watch the Black Lives Matter through CNN and then CBC and other news stations, local news, and seeing these things happen. As you well know, on news, they report it over and over and over and over. They repeat the highlights or the most popular news segments. And so it impacts people because they are supporting those police officers to do their job. And I know Calgary has had some incidents of where our police officers have been involved in situations of assault or excessive use of force. And so we're always kind of sensitive to any type of media and that type. And then it affects the sworn person's morale, but it also affects the civilians, because they're there trying to provide support to them, right?
Mm-hmm. That's kind of like a bit of a limbo area where you're not really sure where your allegiance lies. Is that? Mm-hmm. I think that's really too dramatic what I said, but you know what I mean? Is that?
It's very, very hard, because you have your own opinions. Like, I have my own opinions, but I have to be always cognizant of what I say, because it can impact other people and people can misconstrue what you're saying. And because I'm in a certain work environment, there are things that I might agree with and things that I might not agree with. But I keep my personal opinions to myself.
Okay.
And I often talk about them here at home.
Yeah.
But I don't often talk about them in the work environment.
Okay.
So I'm kind of like, even though I'm being recorded and I know it.
Yeah.
I'm kind of, there's certain things that I even probably wouldn't tell you that I would tell you not.
Yeah.
If I wasn't being recorded, but in this situation, I would probably not.
Yeah, no, that's fair. So on top of that, then my next question might be a little iffy. So if you don't want to respond to it, you don't have to. So have you personally witnessed any discriminatory conduct while working for the city of Calgary or the police service?
Yeah, I would have to say yes. Different types of discrimination, right? Certainly misogyny. Like I've experienced misogynistic sworn members through the years. I've experienced that personally, and it's not pleasant.
Mm-hmm.
That is probably one of the first discriminations I've seen. Discrimination in terms of ethnic and racial. I've worked with a lot of officers from different ethnic and racial backgrounds, and I haven't seen it per se for sworn. For civilians, yeah, definitely. There are work environments that have what I would deem as work ghettos, mostly through the city of Calgary in general, but there are what I would refer to as work ghettos in terms of they seem to be predominantly females. And being a supervisor, I think I've seen that more and more where, you know, the people that I interview are predominantly females from a particular unit within CPS. And it's sort of a career pathing, but at the same time, I like to have diversity. I like to have different genders and people from different ethnic groups to be in the work environment, because I just think it helps us work better together to know that other people have mm-hmm. might have a different opinion about a certain situation.
So
I have experienced it, and I do see it, and I am aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to talk about specifics, if that's okay.
Yeah, that's fine.
But yes, it's there. Our chief has talked about systemic racism. I think my personal opinion is that there's a systemic culture. I think police officers, from the time that they are recruited, that they are told that they are better than other people, or they're held to a higher standard. And so from that, they believe that they're maybe a little bit better or separate from the normal person on the street. And I think that tends to be interpreted differently as they progress through their career. And sometimes I think they lose or their work is influenced by who they think they are, what they think they are. I think they lose sight of the fact that because they're in law enforcement, that they have the right to know better than someone else.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is part of what the chief is referring to, that we don't often make the right decisions, and sometimes it mm-hmm. causes problems. Yeah.
Can you just clarify the term work ghetto, you said?
To me, a work ghetto, and this goes back to my early days of working with the city, where it's a work unit or department where you have a number of people doing the same thing, and they can't get out of there. They can't apply for another job because they don't have the university degree, or they don't have the college diploma, and the only way that they can get out of that into a supervisory position is by having years of experience. And so they get they lose that drive to become maybe better or to move on to, there's no motivation.
Mm-hmm.
So they just go in and they're just doing the same thing day in, day out, and they know that they're going to do this job for the rest of, you know, until they can go to pension. So to me, that's a work ghetto, because they're not going anywhere, and they're doing the same thing over and over and over. And then they start to pick on each other. And it can be a negative work environment. And I guess it's kind of a term that I heard back in the late 80s and early 90s, and maybe not so much anymore, but I think they still exist, mm-hmm. where you get those people who can't move on because, you know, they can't go back to school. They're kind of stuck in their work environment, and I don't know how else to describe it.
Okay. And there was like a gendered aspect to this, is what you're saying. Is there predominantly women?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Let me see where we were. So you're talking about the chief of police, right? And that's Mark Neufeld?
Right.
Okay. So Mark Neufeld responded to calls that there were systemic racism in the city by saying that he wasn't sure. What do you think about that?
I think he's done a good job. I mean, he's brand new to the Calgary area, and he's brand new to the Calgary Police Force. And I think he acknowledges, yeah, that, you know, just like any other police agency, there are problems of racism. And we've looked at the way that our police officers have completed what we would call street checks, or and their terminology that they use, the way that they speak to people. All of those are indicative of biases. And sometimes as a police officer, if you're working in a particular area of the city, you tend to see the same type of people over and over and over, like vulnerable homeless people. So sometimes you'll say something that is a common term used on the street, but it probably is a term that we shouldn't use, because it encourages that word. Or I don't know if I'm explaining this properly, but it's all in our language and how we treat people. And just because you're down and out doesn't mean that, you know, you're a loser or you're this or you're that. And we have to be mindful that, you know, everybody's an individual, right? Yeah. It doesn't matter where you live or what your job is, or the fact that you might not have a job, or, you know, you're bottle picking to get ahead, mm-hmm. or whatever. That doesn't make you less of a human being. And unfortunately, it's not just police officers, but society in general. We tend to measure ourselves by our material
mm-hmm.
property, and it's all image, right? So it's not just the police department, but
no.
It is there.
Yeah.
And I think Mark, the chief, was acknowledging that, and he's trying to change it. And it's hard because he's dealing with the public who are seeing things from the media. And he's also dealing with trying to change an agency, a law enforcement group. But they're looking to him for support and guidance. And when he says, yeah, there's systemic racism, then they're saying he doesn't believe in us. He doesn't support us. And that's hard, because he's coming into a police office or a police agency that had low morale. And he's trying to steer a boat that just won't, you know, you need everybody on board to kind of turn mm-hmm. that boat around, and it's hard.
Yeah. So just speaking on that, I recall, I think it was during the summer or just after the summer, that they released a documentary called Above the Law, mm-hmm. documenting the police service and their numerous cases of, I guess, ethnic attacks, or the way they would handle Indigenous people, and just the way they would just brutalize them.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to go with this, right?
Like, you're talking about law enforcement.
And well, this was particularly the Calgary Police Service.
That particular film was from an incident in 2013. If I'm thinking of the same one that you're thinking of. And there was media of an individual being assaulted, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I forgot where I was going to go with that, actually. So
you were just talking about that.
It left my head, but my actual question. I could keep going, but do you think there needs to be change to the police service?
Yeah.
And what would that be?
Well, I think it just starts right from the beginning, in the terms of the people that we're recruiting. I think and I think Calgary Police Service does recruit minorities and people with diversity. I think we can do a better job of that. And then we need to look at our policies for how we handle situations. I know that as a police agency, we handle a lot of calls that we really shouldn't be involved in, that other our stakeholders or other agencies outside of the police service, they would be best suited to handle those calls. Mm-hmm. We deal with a lot of people with chronic illness, mental health issues, chronic runaways, drug addictions, alcohol addictions, all these things that really aren't crime oriented. And so we get caught up in situations and calls, in expanding a lot of resources and money in dealing with situations and incidents that really would be best placed with another agency. But how do we do that? Because we've created this situation that there's no call too small. We will go to everything and anything. And a lot of times I think our officers are put at risk, or they're expected to find results or deal with a situation that they're not trained to deal with. Mm-hmm. They're not social workers. They don't have a psychology background. They're not, you know what I mean? Like they have to have all of these skills, and yet they're skilled to, respond to public safety, right?
Yeah.
Public safety and crime. That's our priority. But too often we're dealing with calls that really shouldn't be law enforcement calls.
Okay. Sorry, I did remember the question I was going to ask about that documentary. It's a really simple one. I was just going to ask, how did that affect the CPS and your work, like the release of that film?
Well, my work area, we deal with things on a just continual basis. It's like one call, one right after the other. So we just, you know, we deal with it as we just go along with it. And we, you know, there's always another situation that will take our attention, or we've got to focus on something else. So we deal with it. We see it. We acknowledge it. We move on, right? We don't, in the real-time operations center, we just, if it becomes a protracted event, like I said, we'll activate the tactical operations center and they deal with that event. And we'll support them as best as we can, but we don't kind of get stuck on a situation. Now, the analyst in major events and emergency management, she deals with those events. She deals with planned and unplanned events, and her work has increased by almost 300% because COVID has canceled all the planned events, the major planned events that she would do risk assessment and risk triage on, and then we come up with an ops plan of how we're going to handle that planned event. But now they've been, for the most part, unplanned events. So she's been doing a lot of open source searching, and a lot of the groups that she's dealing with are the anti-mass and anti-government. And she has to find up intelligence and information to help us deal with that unplanned event that's going to take place tomorrow in front of City Hall. And so she's got to assess the risk to the public, the risk to our officers. How are we going to respond to that rally or that protest or that that march, right? And because of what we've seen that has happened in the United States, there's this potential that it could happen here in Calgary, right?
Are you referring to the Washington Monument? Or not Monument, sorry, Washington?
A lot of the situations that have happened in the United States, like you talk about Ferguson and then... so many of the areas where they've had protests and march that have resulted in violence. And Calgary, for the most part, we have a relatively peaceful history of protests and rallies in comparison to Toronto and Montreal and Vancouver. Calgary, for some reason, our protesters have remained peaceful. We do have, don't.
Oh, sorry.
Okay.
I have to get the dog.
Yeah.
Because he is crying. Holy. Can I put him outside?
Yeah.
All right. Sorry. It's just.
Don't apologize.
Come on. Bye bye. That was my dog. Sorry. All right. So where were we?
I was just saying Calgary has Like, don't get me wrong, like, we've had a lot of our protests have been peaceful, but there have been a lot of situations where two groups are aggressive with each other, and some, you know, where it has been physically aggressive, or there's a little bit of physical violence and threats and things like that. But I think our law enforcement agency, Calgary Police, I think they deal with it very well.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we have to draw on other resources from other districts to help us handle a situation because we don't have enough officers there if it's starting to escalate. But I think we're able to respond mm-hmm. Pretty good. But back to that analyst position, it puts a lot of stress on her to try to, you know, come up with a risk triage and a risk assessment in a very short period of time. And it's put a lot of stress on that particular position.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we tend to go back to the way it was with planned events, and if the anti-government and anti-mask groups continue, her work is really going to be seriously impacted. She can't sustain it, and I'm either going to have to find someone who can assist her,
mm-hmm.
Or we're going to have to reevaluate what she does focus on.
Yeah. So speaking of the anti-maskers, they've been pretty constant. Almost every weekend they're out, and from what I've been hearing, they've been getting bigger with each coming rally, and they're in public spaces now, like malls. Did your, like, firstly, how do you feel about these groups?
A lot of them are groups that have been around for a while that we know some of the major players, right? And they've just kind of gone from supporters of Black Lives Matter, let's say, to other protests, like protests against pipelines and whatnot. And we've got like the Walk for Freedom and Freedom Walk Calgary, and we've seen these groups kind of come together, and then they have parted ways. For me, when I assist Charmaine, or I kind of do background for her, help her out, she knows these groups very well. She knows some of the major players. She's been able to pick up on certain things that might motivate these individuals. And it's interesting. I think some of them are people who are out of work, and they're wondering why their business had to shut down because of the policies of the government. And I wonder the same thing. How come one business area is shut down over another? I don't understand the algorithms or the rules that the government has applied to certain businesses. I think it's unfair. And so there's a part of me that I understand what they're saying, and I kind of agree with it. But I'm not at that point where, you know, I'll go out and protest. I don't really believe that protests really amount to anything. Honestly, don't.
Mm-hmm. So what do you mean by the two businesses? Like, there's two different treatments. Like, there's one.
So for instance, just before Christmas, the government of Alberta, Premier Kenney, he closed down barbershops, salons, small grocery stores, whatever. There was casinos and things like that. And yet he let other businesses stay open.
Such as
Walmart, right? Mm-hmm. Grocery stores, because they're considered essential. I'm sorry. I don't understand the formula there. Okay. I don't understand the thinking that, because the barbershops and the beauty salons had already proven that none of the COVID cases had come back to beauty salons or barbershops. So why would you close that? Those are people that they are small businesses. They're not chains for mm-hmm. the most part. There's some chains, don't get me wrong, but these, their livelihood. And I can only speak from like the perspective of my hairstylist, and she was closed down. She had to move out of her place of business. She had to go and sign another lease with another location. And she said, if I get closed down again, she goes, I'm not going to be able to survive.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to be able to and she lost staff. She lost customers. And she was doing everything that was asked of her.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, for me, I just feel that, why is there a certain contingent or population that, as far as I'm concerned, were isolated and, for lack of a better description, I would say discriminated against.
Okay. Moving on, we're just going to finish the last question here about this summer. So I recently seen that the Anti-Racism Committee has just been recently formed and has just begun working as of the 1st. So do you think they'll be successful in implementing successful change to the police force? Sorry, that we jumped around a lot. This is my fault.
No, that's okay. And so you're talking about an anti-racism unit within the Calgary Police Service that has just recently been formed. And I really can't speak to it. I honestly can't. I have opinions, and I'll say this.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's good that they created it. Whether or not they're going to make a change, only time will tell. And I hope that they are successful in making some changes. But knowing what I know from my career within the CPS, I'm not going to hold my breath.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So now let's move on to the next group of questions, and this would be about the Golden Handshake.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you've been working for quite a while with the city, and I'm aware that the City of Calgary slashed the Golden Handshake. Can you tell me exactly what that is?
The Golden Handshake is a term that really, since 1964, the City of Calgary has given their employees, they will match their holidays. So when an employee reaches retirement, they get a payout of their holidays. So let's say if you were an employee who worked 30 years. So a 30-year employee with the City of Calgary, depending on what union or agreement you have with the city, after 30 years of service, you might have anywhere from 6 to 7 to 8 weeks of annual vacation. And some employees over the years have been able to build up and save those holidays. And so what the city does is if you get 8 weeks of holidays at the end of your 30 years, they will pay out those 8 weeks of holidays on your anniversary date or the date that you get those holidays.
Mm-hmm.
But the city matches them. So you not only would you get your 8 weeks of pay for the holidays, but the city gives you an additional 8 weeks of pay to say thank you for your service. So 16 weeks of pay. Right? Mm-hmm. For some people, that's a lot of money. That's been going on since 1964. And Councillor Jeremy Farkas found out about it and said, no more. We're not going to do this anymore. And a City of Calgary employee is not allowed to accept anything. We're not allowed to accept a thank you card. Like, we get thank you cards, granted, but we're not allowed to accept anything of monetary value. Chocolate bar, pop, bouquet of flowers, a gift card, nothing. We can't accept anything from the public. We don't get any bonuses other than our holidays. Training, going on trips, that is considered a privilege. And everything is documented, and we get reimbursed for anything that goes towards that trip and nothing more.
Mm-hmm.
So this year, Councillor Farkas said no more. He's putting an end to the Golden Handshake. So anybody who retires after December of 2021
mm-hmm.
no longer gets that Golden Handshake. So any employee that was hired prior to probably, any employee that's hired after what I think it's 1995 will no longer get that golden handshake. Mm-hmm. To me, that's discriminatory. To me, and then when I look at it, I just think how unfair. It's a slap in the face to those employees that are what 2, 5, 6 years away from that. But you gave it to what employees for the last 50 some odd years, and now all of a sudden we're not going to do that. So this year alone, the city of Calgary is going to see a massive exodus of employees because they're going to take that golden handshake. So the city is going to pay a huge amount of money to retired employees that they normally would never have paid that amount because and they're never going to recuperate from that because they're never going to be able to recoup the loss of employees that they're losing because of that golden handshake. So he might think that he's done the city a great service by saving money, but in the long run, the city's going to pay out a huge amount of money that they probably don't have in their coffers. It's probably going to cost the city a lot more money in the long run. Mm-hmm. Good on him. What a wonderful person he is. Because there has been nothing to motivate a city employee but that golden handshake. And now that it's gone, that motivation goes. And so no one in their right mind will want to stay with the city for 25 or 30 years and say, no, we're out of here. Why should I stay? There's no loyalty. You don't get anything. Mm-hmm. I certainly don't. He's totally destroyed my motivation for being a city employee. And that's the thanks you get for being loyal and doing a pretty good job. And you look in the oil and gas industry in the city of Calgary. Calgary's been built on the oil and gas industry. And because we're going through an economic downturn, you penalize the people that have given you some loyalty. The oil and gas industry have always, always provided bonuses to their employees for their service. Mm-hmm. And this is how Councillor Farkas treats City of Calgary employees. He's a wonderful individual, and I say that with as much sarcasm as I mm-hmm. possibly can. He's great.
Yeah. So now we'll move on to the final question sheet here. One of the final ones, and this is just about the pandemic today. Sorry. So do you think eventually that work will return to how it was in 2019?
No.
No, not at all?
No.
Okay. Why would that be?
Well, I think the work has pretty much stayed the same. I think what is going to change is the work environment. We've proven that people can work successfully from home. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they're more productive from home. So I think in that sense, I think you're going to see a lot more people opting for the ability to telework, maybe not 4 days a week, but 2 days in the office and 2 days at home. I think that's where the work environment is going to change. I think we're going to see, like before the COVID, the commuting traffic was horrendous. I think we could argue that if I work from home, I'm not contributing to the pollution by driving my car every day. I don't need to take the LRT, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things that to me, I think are positive that have come from this and from working from home. I think there's negatives as well, mm-hmm. but I think we can work around some of those negatives.
Okay. So, yeah, that answers the
question. I mean, I don't have the specifics as how I think it's going to, but I think it's ultimately it has changed and it's going to continue to change.
Thank you. Next, with the gradual rollout of the federal vaccine distribution plan, has the atmosphere in the office changed at all?
Not really. I think, for me, our officers, I think they were saying that our officers, the frontline, or our first responders, should be getting the vaccine by the beginning of April. And I think that will help a lot of them deal with, the PPE, because the PPE that they wear every day is, it's not that comfortable, and they have to do it, from a car, which is extremely hard for them, mm-hmm. And it's uncomfortable. When you think about all the other equipment that they have to wear, they've adapted very well. I think for them, it will help them tremendously. In terms of the office and my personnel, I think some of them will feel less anxious if they have the vaccine. So, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, they've really done a good job, and we haven't had any positive COVID cases, knock on wood, but I anticipate that it will probably reduce some of the stress.
Okay. Thank you. When are you going to be receiving the vaccine, or do you intend on receiving it?
Yeah, I don't know, though.
Oh.
I guess when my time comes up. If they offer it to us, I'll take it at work. If they don't, I'll do it, you know, when I'm eligible based upon my age.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And you were just talking about, like, it's uncomfortable to wear a mask, but do you see yourself carrying out any pandemic precautions or practices after it's over?
Yeah, I think, you know, time will tell. I think I will continue to wear a mask when I'm out in public, wherever I am, until I feel comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's so many, they talk about the variants and whatnot, but I think we'll see, personally myself, I will probably continue to have a mask with me and wear a mask when I'm going into a public place. Yeah, okay. For quite a while.
All right. And when do you think the pandemic will officially end, in your just best guess?
Officially, I think we're in it to the end of 2021. I don't know why, but I think we're going to see some changes as we move into the fall and the winter. I would say by the spring of 2022, I would think that maybe a year from now.
Okay.
Right? Mm-hmm. Hopefully.
And why do you think it might take that long?
Just in terms of what we've seen so far, right?
Mm-hmm.
The numbers that you just think that it's getting better, and then the numbers start to creep up again, or you see another variant, and then there's other risks that are identified. I think just like anything, you want to be cautious.
Now we're just going to move on to the conclusion. Mm-hmm. So what have you learned over this past year, or rather, what is the most positive thing to come out of this pandemic for you?
My son.
Oh, thank you.
I think because you've been home and you are very, very cautious and very much aware of what's going on. I tend to be less cautious because of I'm still out and I'm working and I'm out and about and getting things and grocery shopping and I wear my mask, and I think that's sufficient. And I've always been, I'm totally opposite from you in that you're very cautious and I'm just the opposite. I always kind of a risk taker to some extent. And if it happens, it happens. I don't wish anybody to be sick, and I certainly don't want to be the person who is one of those asymptomatic carriers, and I worry about that. But I think in light of what you have done in terms of I know you're not happy being home. I know that you want to be out and about, and I want you to. I think you're missing out on a certain aspect of your development in your young life, and I want you to be able to experience that, and you haven't been able to, and yet you've remained positive and focused, and that says a lot to me, and that's extremely positive for me to see that in you, because it's so easy to be negative and get depressed and get down and so on, can't do this, can't do that, and yet you have remained diligent and focused and disciplined, more so disciplined than maybe I am. And you amaze me. Oh. So I'm very proud of you, and I think you're the positive spot of my life, if I can say that.
Thank you. That's really
without,
sweet.
Without, like, being too, you know, sappy.
Thanks, Mom.
Yeah.
Thank you. The final question.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything else you'd like to say, or other topics you'd like to touch upon?
You know, there's so much that I would like to say, but because I'm being recorded, I'm just always apprehensive. Mm-hmm. Because of my work, I have always been super sensitive about what I talk about and what I can talk about. I am very opinionated and very verbose, and I am often, I'm wrong. And I think it's important to be able to acknowledge that I'm still learning. I'm 57. I'm a lifelong learner. And I'm still learning. So, and I'm not afraid to admit that I'm often wrong, that my perceptions are flawed, and that I am biased. And I have a tendency to focus on something negatively. And I think, again, that's where I'm appreciative of you to sometimes say, you know, there's a different way of looking at that, or I think you're wrong, or please don't say that because it means this and this and this, and you don't like it when I say that, or I say it, I make a certain comment, and you will immediately identify to me that that's not correct and it's not appropriate. And you're not admonishing me, you're just educating me. And so I appreciate that, because I think I went through that with my mom. And so I think that's part of your responsibility is to continue to educate me.
Thank you.
And I'm sorry I put that burden on you, but no, I think it's okay. Really important, because I am not right. And part of it is my culture. Part of it is of my, like, my work culture. I think I have a tendency in this interview. I said some things, and I, you know, there's part of me that I don't necessarily agree with what I said, but I can't say anything different because just of the situation. I think if you ask me 10 years from now, my questions will be different. But I have been, I'm in a situation where I feel to some extent, I'm very, very fortunate with the people that I've had the opportunity to work with. I've seen people that have been marginalized and devalued, and they are fantastic people. They didn't deserve it, but because they are from a certain ethnic group, because they don't speak English, or they don't enunciate their words properly, they have been passed over for promotion. I've seen that myself these past 5 years. I've experienced it myself. The fact that I've gotten older and I've put on weight, I am looked at differently at work, and I'm treated differently at work. And I think that that is something that people just refuse to acknowledge, but it happens every day. And if we can change things, I think racism, as you said to me and you educated me, Black Lives Matter first and then all lives matter. And it seems so simple to explain that. And it's the same when we talk about systemic racism and systemic cultures in our these work environments, that until we acknowledge that we treat people differently, where nothing's going to change. So you can create as many units as you want with as many different names as you want, but until you acknowledge that there are problems, you're not going to fix that problem. And if you put the wrong people in those units, you're not going to fix it. You're just going to, it's smoke and mirrors, and you say all the right words, but you don't actually fix anything. And I've seen that happen over and over and over. And after a while, you get tired of people saying, hey, I'm doing a good job. Yeah, you're doing a great job. We're not. And I think that there's a lot of evidence to show that we're not.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for your time. I really enjoyed interviewing you, and I hope you did too. But yeah, thank you so much. That will conclude the interview.
Thank you.
Oh, no worries. And I'm just going to stop recording right now. Thank you.